I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case set for oral argument at 1:30, and then we'll take a break, and we have a couple more set for 3 o'clock. So if everybody's here for the first case, which I understand they are, I will ask the clerk to let me introduce the panel members first, even though we have nameplates. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. I'm Elizabeth Kerr, and to my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. So. If you call the case, please.
The court will now call Ulysses Asset Sub I LLC versus Sinclair Holdings LLC. Led to the court. Mr. Ken McKay will argue for the appellant. Ms. Caitlin Hubbard will argue for the appellee.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Ken McKay with the Becker Donaldson Law Firm here on behalf of appellant. Get it exactly right. Ulysses Asset Sub 1 LLC in this appeal related to the dissolution of a temporary injunction in state court. May it please the court. Just from the back and forth of the various briefings, both in the lower court and particularly in this court, it seems to me that we are confronted with basically two questions. The first question is this: to what degree should a Texas court require actual evidence of changed circumstances before review of the merits of a motion to dissolve a temporary injunction? I suppose, couched by the appellee, they would say, if any. The second question that is perhaps not expressly stated in anyone's briefing, but which is underlying implicit in all of that, is this: what is the extent of the rights of an easement holder determined by the current exercise of those rights, or is that determined solely by the terms of the easement document itself? With regard to the first question, regard changed circumstances, certainly there has been longstanding law that's cited in both briefs that suggests that perhaps that the very purpose of a motion for dissolution of a temporary injunction is to show that something has changed. In fact, we see a number of cases cited that suggest that it is an abuse of discretion, the standard that we're looking at here, if a temporary injunction is dissolved without showing some evidence of changed circumstances. In the briefing that we have seen for the first time, appellee arguing the idea that there are cases in the state of Texas that suggest, if not outright state, that there are specific circumstances, specific unique situations, in which no showing of changed circumstances is mandatory. Those cases exist. They say that. We can distinguish them in their facts, and they certainly are distinguishable, but we can't deny the fact that there are cases that just say that. The principal cases that are discussed come from dicta on cases that, based on cases that don't say that, and many of those cases that have that language are actually cases in which they discuss changed circumstances and do that analysis. The fact of the matter is that that argument wasn't made in the trial court, and that's fine, but the fact of the matter is that the reason why we're having that discussion, the reason why they're now arguing that, is because there was a total failure of evidence at the trial court level to show at the hearing on motion for dissolution that there were changed circumstances. In fact, we see that as we get the briefing here at this court, yet a third position being taken as to what, in their estimation, qualifies as the changed circumstances in this situation. So we're in a situation where I think that argument is made by necessity, because the fact is there's just been a total failure of evidence at that hearing in the submissions to show any changed circumstances. The only evidence that was submitted at the hearing on behalf of Sinclair, the appellee, was the testimony of its own witness, its own principal. And now, in order to show changed circumstances, they are attributing testimony of which he could have had no knowledge, or testimony from the witness that the appellant called, which had no direct knowledge of the AT&T antennas, AT&T technology, or development, which they are arguing is the basis for it. So in and of itself, It's certainly an indication that there was no evidence that supported any changed circumstances.
But your witness certainly said that acknowledged the antennas had been moved and there'd been no disruption in service that he was aware of.
Well, and the last clause is the important part. The witness that we called was a regional manager for Ulysses, for ATC. Not an employee of AT&T, not an expert on this, not anybody who professed to have actual knowledge of what had or hadn't happened. He certainly had knowledge that those antenna had been moved. He had, what he testified to was he had no knowledge whether or not there had been any problems at the time related to the movement of the antenna, which is why we, not to avoid the topic, but is why I brought in the second question, because it is implicit in all of the arguments made by Appalee about how you measure what the rights are. So are the rights, are the rights measured by what is the actual usage of the easement rights today, or is this measured by what's the extent of the rights as indicated by the easement? And so necessarily for them to make the argument, well, we don't see any evidence one way or the other as to whether or not there's been any outage in the network, whether there's been any dropped calls, whether there's been any 911 problems, which, by the way, I'll add, obviously, was their burden at the motion for dissolution, suggest that.
Counsel, it's not the requirement for a dissolution of changed circumstances. Is that not predicated on the fact that there's been an adjudication of the factual circumstances that underline the temporary injunction when it is entered by the court? The court is making a factual determination based upon the evidence from the temporary injunction hearing, making findings of fact with regard to what the factual circumstances are, and therefore, in order for a party to obtain a dissolution, they have to show that the facts are either changed, basically are changed. They have to show that there's been something after the adjudication of the evidence with regard to the temporary injunction has in fact changed. And the problem I have with this particular temporary injunction is it reads more like a Rule 11 agreement, because there are no actual facts discussed here other than the existence of the easement. Everything is in terms of plaintiffs allege, the allegations, etc. So how is it possible to apply a changed circumstances analysis when in fact there's been no actual adjudication? It was an agreed temporary injunction, but the agreement did not, basically it was an agreement to disagree as to the facts.
Well, and I understand the question, and there has been some discussion about that. Now, obviously the first aspect of that, it was an agreed temporary injunction. And so certainly there is explicitly in the injunction itself an agreement by both of the parties that circumstances exist which justify that remedy. And we know that the circumstances were going in both directions, right? The circumstances from the perspective of my client was, we understood that certain construction efforts need to be undertaken in connection with things other than the rooftop bar, which in our estimation didn't infringe on the rights of the easement. And so part of that agreement was to say, okay, we agree that this specific kind of construction activity that we contemplate is to be permitted and would not infringe on the easement. On the other hand, what we have in the agreement from the other side is, okay, there is a certain group of construction activities, that is those things which exclusively relate to the rooftop bar, in which they agreed constitute the type of activity which would create a factual basis for a temporary injunction.
Is the rooftop bar up there now?
Excuse me?
Is the rooftop bar up there now? Has it been completed?
I will say that I don't represent them. I don't know the answer to that question, but I assume that when the stay was denied, they moved as fast as they could, which is another problem, right? That's another situation, another reason that I was cited in the brief, because I asked this question: how is the construction of a rooftop bar not in and of itself irreparable injury? To which the question I got from the trial court was, well, can't they just knock it down? And my answer was, that's a good question. What we heard both at the hearing and in the briefing is, we can knock it down. And so, I mean, that's, obviously that that affects a number of the questions that we have.
Where physically is this bar either in existence or proposed to have been built in relation to the HVAC equipment that was on the rooftop before? In other words, your client never had a clean slate roof up there for its easement, right?
At the time, we sure didn't. That's true.
So your client was all right with existing structures on the roof. What was it about this bar in its location? I mean, the antennas have been moved now.
Well,
apparently.
The existing antennas have been moved.
Right. But let's say that everything had stayed the same and the HVAC equipment stayed the same. Would that not have interfered with potential future antenna placement too?
Well, I will say this, that obviously, and I made allusion to this as related to even the other construction work which was permitted under the temporary injunction. Obviously, no one has taken the position that zero activity can occur on the rooftop. What the standard imposed by the easement and the standard that which we advocate here is those activities that unreasonably interfere with the rights that we paid for, that we paid money for, that was accepted by Appalee in the process. So obviously part of the problem is not knowing the full extent of it. Part of the problem is you're talking about a different sort of character of use. So part of it is location, and I know that there is some overlap, some significant overlap as to where the HVAC originally was. But you're also talking about some places that are different, and you're talking about having human beings up there on top of a roof, which is a different character of use than just having fixed pieces of equipment where there is no human traffic and so forth. And so those types of things, based upon what we've seen, based upon the experts internally that we have used, found that to be an objectionable use based upon not just the structure, but also the location, and also the character of the use.
And these are all great questions, but aren't those questions that we need to be resolved in the final trial of this case, rather than on the record, the scant record we have up here?
Well, I think that's the problem you run into with any injunctive relief, right? I mean, the sense that we have to. That's why there is a burden of proof for the evidence, right? And so I would suggest to you that if that is a problem, that's a problem that the appellee has. That's a problem that they had the burden to prove. They had the burden to establish these kinds of things, having already an existing temporary injunction in place. The law that we've seen, which I think is good law and never been contradicted, is if they don't show change, if they don't show substantial difference from the facts that existed at the time it was entered, then that's a failure on their part, and that presumption is in the holder of the injunction itself.
Well, let me ask you this. It looks to me like the imminent and irreparable injury that's referenced in the agreed temporary injunction is basically that people are unable to place 911 emergency calls and receive first responder and rescue services. At this point in time, it appears that, hypothetically, the rooftop bar is built. AT&T has moved the antennas in a manner that satisfies it. And I understand you disagree with this, but your representative testified he knew of there were of no other problems. Well, so let me hold on. The first question is, isn't the fact that the antennas have been successfully moved with no interruption in service a changed circumstance? And second of all, why isn't this matter moot?
A couple things. First of all, we know for a fact, and Sinclair's representative testified at the hearing, that the first time these antennas were moved, it did disrupt the system, it did throw them off the network, it did shut them down. That is an unequivocal truth. Secondly, the part that I've already taken issue with is the idea that they call no witness, they offer no evidence, and the only evidence that they refer to and that you included in your question is rank hearsay by someone who absolutely had zero knowledge and it was no position to make that call. That burden of proof was not on us. That burden of proof was on them. If there is a failure, then the injunction, the injunction shouldn't have been dissolved. Now, as to mootness, you know, that's a whole nother can of worms, because you've got layers and layers and layers on that, right? You have the issue of, well, we are where we are. But I made this very same argument, Justice, at the hearing, and they said to us, tearing it down is no problem. We'll tear it down in a heartbeat, and they've said it in their briefing. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running out of time here. So if we send this back to the trial court, are you going to ask them to tear the rooftop bar off?
Well, the remedy that we're seeking is the reinstitution of the injunction. I don't know the current status of construction, and I will say to you, I think there will be some discussions in that regard if that occurs. But irrespective of that, you know, our position is, no matter what the status of construction is, we have the right to this injunction because they have failed the evidence. And to say that because in the interim they have hurried up and construct the bar, and that changes who has the right and what rights on the easement, it's just wrong.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Response?
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Caitlin Hubbard, and I represent Sinclair, the owner of the Sinclair building at issue in this dispute. The trial court had ample discretion, and arguably even a duty, to dissolve a temporary injunction based on the record before it. And with great respect to appellant in this case, you would not know from the argument of the briefing submitted that it is who now bear the great burden of demonstrating a clear abuse of discretion in reaching that decision. We respectfully submit that to this day, they have not and cannot meet that burden. And the reason for that ultimately is twofold. Number one, we do make the argument, and perhaps the most straightforward ground for affirmance, is the record does support changed circumstances. And you've heard a bit about that, and you've asked some questions, I will get to them. But second, more fundamentally, ELISA simply misstates the legal standard. And we don't argue this, as they say, out of necessity. We argue it because, as appellate practitioners, we think it's relevant to always get the threshold legal standard right. So I'll start there. Now, at least four Texas courts of appeal have held that a trial court retains its inherent discretion and plenary authority to dissolve a temporary injunction even absent proof of changed circumstances. Now, that holding started with the Austin Court of Appeals 1984 decision in Tober versus Turner of Texas.
I'm going back to Rule 11 here. This is an agreed temporary injunction, okay? How does the court retain its jurisdiction to dissolve something that it is bound by the rules to enforce as an agreement between the parties?
I have two answers to that question. I'm glad you brought it up. Number one, not to avoid your question, but Tober and all of these authorities, you're absolutely correct to point out, they all started from the premise that there had been a full evidentiary hearing on the merits. So you're correct absolutely as to that. With respect to changed circumstances, however, a changed circumstance is anything that affects a change in the status quo, whether agreement of the parties or newly revealed facts. So in this case...
Well, let me ask you one question. What fact did you not know when you agreed to the temporary injunction that you learned later?
We did not know, number one, that there would be no interruption. We certainly believed, but we did not know that there would be no interruption to wireless services, which is what they really alleged, to get the TRO. And number two, again, while we believed, we did not know because, again, there was no opportunity for discovery. There was no fully fledged evidentiary hearing. We did not know that the leasing opportunities were really speculative and unripe, and in fact, did not actually exist. So to answer your question, Justice Basil, that would be the answer. And again, when the standard is whether changed circumstances have changed the status quo, whether by agreement or by really anything that comes along that renders the injunction no longer appropriate, that is satisfied in the record on this case. But moving back to Tober and to get back to your question, we agree with you absolutely that this agreement contains no actual and concrete findings of fact ordinarily required. The parties just agreed that, look, this is your position and this is mine. And that ties somewhat into our argument presented in our briefs that you didn't hear anything about today, that this is why Sinclair specifically bargained for a provision in that agreement that says nothing in this agreement takes away our right to rescind or modify this agreement at issue. So to the extent
it says nothing in this agreement shall bar other parties from seeking rescission or modification of this order? How does that alter whatever standard we determine should apply in this case?
I have two answers to that question, and I take it that you're leading a bit off of what Ulysses put in their brief, which was their principal argument that the parties cannot contract around substantive Texas law. We do agree that there's limits, certainly, but I can think of at least two circumstances where parties can do just that. As this court is well aware, parties by agreement, inadvertence, or mistake can submit a charge to a jury that is based on an improper standard of a Texas cause of action. When this court gets it to review, if there was no objection or if it was by agreement,
My question's a little, is kind of a shade and phase of that. How does that provision say that the parties are applying any other standard than what we ever determined it to be in the case law? Whatever the standard, whether it's always can change an interlocutory order or change circumstances. It doesn't appear that that provision does anything other than saying you can go to the court and ask the court to rescind or modify the injunction, but doesn't say we're going to utilize any other standard than whatever is determined to be the appropriate standard.
I understand your position, absolutely. I think that when an agreed order is interpreted according to settled principles of contract law, that the answer to that question would be that would be entirely redundant, to the extent that, as Ulysses suggests, changed circumstances are in fact required. And our position is that they're not. And to the extent that they're not, even if they were, in this case, Sinclair specifically bargained for, because it was really put between a rock and a hard place. 4:30 Friday afternoon, parade of horribles coming down on downtown Fort Worth. We understand why the trial court entered a TRO based on those allegations and with limited time left in the day. But we were left with a $55 million refurbishment, and it wasn't just the rooftop bar. It was the entire refurbishment that was halted. Of course, we went to Ulysses and tried to negotiate some agreement, but we were careful in what we did, because we did not have any actual evidence to determine if their allegations were true. And when we went to the motion for dissolution and we came to the dissolution hearing, there was evidence deduced showing newly revealed facts, which is a changed circumstance as a matter of law. And I've heard some suggestion that this court shouldn't rely on that evidence because it's hearsay or perhaps there wasn't foundation. Respectfully, Your Honors, I didn't hear those objections. I didn't see them in the record when I reviewed it. So as to those specific arguments, I'd argue them waived. But certainly there's no dispute, and I still haven't heard the dispute today, that the antennas haven't been moved or that there's any suggestion that they're going to be moved again. And moving on to that point, I think you raised the question, Justice Basil, as to mootness. We will not take the position in this court that this court has no jurisdiction to issue its decision or to review whether the trial court committed a clear abuse of discretion in determining that the temporary injunction is no longer appropriate. I believe that this court has that power. Now, whether, given that, and I admit I have not been on the Sinclair Building's rooftop, I don't know the exact status of the bar. I can see from my office that it appears to have been largely constructed. So I think it's there. I think that to the extent, for the sake of argument, that for some reason this court found the court had committed an abuse of discretion, there would be a changed circumstance in that the bar is completed that we would need to reassess at the trial court level. Ultimately, Your Honors, this case presents an interesting legal dispute on the merits. And as to all of those issues, that issue is in arbitration properly. But Ulysses cannot come in here today and show a clear abuse of discretion based on merits-based issues. And honestly, both parties before the court today have property rights at issue.
What did you just say about, has someone invoked the arbitration clause?
Yes, the arbitration proceedings have been instituted. Absolutely. Our main point today is that both parties have property rights at issue as a servient dominant estate holder. And yet, before the trial court and before this court, the only non-speculative evidence is that it is Sinclair whose property rights were both interrupted and affected. That evidence simply does not exist. And for those reasons, this court should affirm.
Just one quick question before you step away. Ulysses makes the argument that it extends over the entire rooftop. There's been some comment here about whether or not the bar ends up covering a portion of where the HVAC system actually was, that type of thing. Okay. Right. What I haven't seen in either of the briefs is what it means to have an easement over a
roof that has fixtures, okay? And I haven't seen anything in the briefing with regard to, are the fixtures removable pursuant to the easement? Are they not removable to the easement? If that easement is on top of the roof with the fixtures in place at the time the easement was entered into, but there is no provision in the easement for the removal of the fixtures, then that would seem to indicate that the easement is with regard, is qualified by the fixtures already in place.
We would agree with that.
Okay. But also, would not the temporary injunction, because it allows a change in the roof that includes stairwell access, et cetera, which also will change the fixtures on the roof, has that not affected a modification of the easement itself because it is an agreed change of the easement because it changes the structure of the roof?
You know, Justice Burrell, I think that's a really interesting question. Ultimately, I think it goes more into the merits of the terms of the easement and what the roof structures really means and roof when defined under the terms of that easement. For purposes of today, our primary point that we really want to emphasize is that unless and until Ulysses adduces evidence that whatever is on the roof, whether pre-existing or today, actually interferes with their easement rights, they cannot show a clear abuse of discretion by the trial court. And
there's a method to the madness, because what that demonstrates is that there's no real adjudication of facts in this. It's characterized as a temporary injunction. The order uses the word enjoin, but it doesn't meet the qualifications of 683. If it hadn't included a trial date, it would be void as a matter of law, and there would be no jurisdiction. If this is a Rule 11 agreement fashioned in the form of a temporary injunction, then we don't even have jurisdiction under the interlocutory appeal situation. You asked for a dissolution of the agreement, of the Rule 11 agreement, the order enforcing the Rule 11 agreement.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the parties fashioned it as a agreed temporary injunction, and the trial court signed it. Now, whether it's void because it doesn't comply with 683, the proper remedy, in our opinion, would be to void the temporary injunction, just like the dissolution did. I do not believe that this court is divested of jurisdiction, and in candor, I admit that I don't believe either party has briefed this issue, so if you'd like us to submit some supplemental authorities on the point, we'd be happy to do so.
Let me ask you one thing. You rely on Tober primarily, but Tober's certainly been criticized down through the years. So why should we go with Tober rather than the other cases? And specifically, Tober itself says that if you allow the trial court complete discretion to do away with a temporary injunction, then all you're doing is opening the opportunity for the other side to wear down the trial court and the other parties by continuing to file motions to dissolve. So we need some check on that in the form of the changed circumstance criteria. Oh. Why should we go with Tober rather than those other cases?
My primary response is that evidence of changed circumstances does exist.
Understand.
In that case. So, but assuming for the sake of argument, Tober includes that important qualification. We should not be heard to say that a trial court lacks discretion to rescind a temporary injunction even absent proof of changed circumstances. Quote, it does have that power. And in fact, Tober could reach no other holding because the Texas Supreme Court and this court have held that a trial court retains continuing and plenary jurisdiction all the way up until final judgment to modify its interlocutory decrees. So certainly we concede Tober advocates the wisdom of a changed circumstance standard. And I believe it includes some language in there that says, you know what, to entice parties not to come back to the court. Again, Tober and all of these others were after a full evidentiary hearing on the merits where the trial court actually had an opportunity to adjudicate the facts, which I think, if anything, even bolsters dissolution in this case. But even so, Tober said, look, to induce you not to come back to this court and relitigate the very same issues that we've already heard and rejected, we're going to impose a standard that the trial court can, in fact, deny it on the pleadings, no hearing on the motion for dissolution. And if you try to appeal that, you cannot, as a matter of law, prove a clear abuse of discretion absent pleading and proof of changed circumstances. And that is the legal standard that entices parties not to come back to the court with no basis to do so. That does not, however, limit the trial court's authority or jurisdiction to dissolve when a temporary injunction is no longer appropriate. And when a trial court does so, it is this court's task to determine if that was a clear abuse of discretion. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple things in follow-up to those questions. First, the question about the nature of the temporary injunction itself. And I would say that a couple of comments in that regard. In the event we are contemplating resolving this appeal based upon a lack of findings, therefore an inability for us to demonstrate no change circumstances, that same argument should apply to the trial court. That is, if no specific findings are set forth in the temporary injunction, then how can they define what has changed? Okay, so it's the same argument flipped on its head, and we're talking about sort of the actions of the trial court in reviewing and grading their paper in this circumstance. I'll also say that with regard to the language that the argument, I understand that there are some honest arguments with regard to some of the issues in this case. The idea that we somehow agreed to vary the standard of review by boilerplate provision in a temporary injunction order, I think calls into question the credibility of all the other arguments. When you can sit there and say that all that I have been preached at for all the time I've been practicing law is that we encourage parties to agree. We encourage people to try to work things out. We encourage to try to settle things and resolve things. And here we are sitting in a situation where that's exactly what we did. That's exactly what we did. And what happens? We come to that point where Sinclair takes full advantage of the agreements that Ulysses gave, that is the ability to go and do the construction unrelated to the rooftop bar, and when they took full advantage of that, then they come in and say, oh, but we really didn't mean what we said. And I think that there are equity issues that go into that as well. With regard to the issue that that Justice Bassel asked, I think the question you asked was, what did they not know? And the answer was, well, we didn't have a chance for a full evidentiary hearing. Well, wait, that's what it was. That's what the temporary injunction hearing, that's what the motion for dissolution was. It was a full evidentiary hearing, and they had the burden to say, hey, no evidence was introduced about that. That's on them. That's not on us. And that was absolutely a full evidentiary hearing. They brought witnesses. We brought witnesses. Documents were admitted to say, hey, just throw up your hands and say, we don't know. That's not an argument that goes in their favor. And I think that's something that's I don't get from the problem. They had the responsibility to harness the evidence. They had the responsibility to show up with an expert on something if they thought that was an issue. And the failure for there to be any evidence goes in favor of the appellant on this one. The abuse of discretion is, and this is in Tober, this is in a number of other cases, is the failure to require that they show changed circumstances in and of itself is abuse of discretion as a matter of law. And so the issue is not have we suggested in our briefing something that rises to the standard of abuse of discretion when we have said they have not shown, changed circumstances, and that's exemplified by the fact that not only have they changed their story three times, but they can't answer it straight here in the Court of Appeals. And so that's the frustrating part of it. The frustrating part of it is we know they rely on Tober. Tober spends paragraphs talking about how important it is to show changed circumstances, of the abuses that could result if you don't show changed circumstances. And I think this is just one of those cases. One of those cases where one side takes full advantage of an injunction and then comes back and says they want to, the part that they don't like, they want to come back and change. Why do they want to change it? Because they have a financial investment in a project. The financial investment of the project does in no way affect the easement rights of my client. The fact that there may be some fixtures that we permitted, well, if we permitted that, then probably there's some argument to be made that that we have decided that doesn't impose on the powers or the rights of the easement. But the very fact that we hear shows that there are some. And there is no waiver just because we allowed some fixtures to get put on. But then we objected to others. That's no waiver there, because every character, every encroachment is its own, and there is no language in the easement. There's nothing cited to in law that suggests that we waive any rights by allowing one fixture or one part of construction to do that. That's something, frankly, that we researched at length before we allowed the temporary injunction to be put in place. So here we are, hoist by our own petard. We try to be the good neighbor. We try to come to an agreement. We try to give them the benefit of their investment, allow them to do the kind of construction work that we know is right. And when they get done with us, then they now claim a standard that's not supported in law.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you all.
All right. Thank you, both sides, for the argument. It was very helpful. And your case is submitted.